This is the Podium Finish Live from Austin, Texas, and various points across the country. Here's your host, Rob Tiansen.
And a good day to everyone out there listening to us on your preferred podcasting platform. Welcome to episode number 76 of TPF Live, the world's fastest hour of racing talk. Yeah, I'm not even saying the Podium Finish Live anymore. I'm your host, Rob Tiansen, and I'm joined alongside, as always, Nathan Solomon, and we're so happy that you could join us for the post-Nashville, pre-Chicago edition of this podcast. Yes, folks, we're now on the NBC USA schedule section of the NASCAR season, except for trucks, which of course is always on Fox and FS1 or FS2, but on the Cup and Xfinity side, it's all about the Peacock and the flag. Except it's USA or USA. Anyways, folks, we have a lot to get to on this 4th of July holiday weekend edition of TPF Live. Of course, we're excited about Chicago Street Course Racing, unprecedented for the Cup Series, of course, and Xfinity Series as well. But we also have IndyCar at Mid-Ohio Sports Car Course. We've also got F1 going on in the Austrian Grand Prix. And then, of course, just a lot to get to on this particular edition of the podcast, because we've got three hot seat guests today or tonight, whatever, whenever you're listening to this show, folks, because on this edition of TPF Live, we've got Mike Rockenfeller, who drove in the Garage 56 entry just recently in the Le Mans 24, and also to... He has dabbled in various cup races in the past year. We've also got Landon Lewis from the Arca Menards West Series. He, of course, is a points-leading contending driver in the West Coast in what you would call one of the racing ladder series for stock cars. And then also, of course, he is a member of the Team Hornaday Development Group. So that's going to be fun to talk to him on the show. And of course, we have Alexander Rossi, driver of the number 7 Aero Dallara Chevrolet McLaren ride in the NTT IndyCar series. So a little bit of everything on the show: sports cars, stock cars, IndyCars. See, folks, we go all out on TPF Live. So you're in the right place to sit back and relax for what should be a little bit over an hour, but we're going to do our best to keep it within the hour. No promises, of course. Anyways, let's get to it with Nathan, of course, because he's here, he's ready to go, and I know he's got a lot of opinions once we get to putting perspectives and all. So, Nathan, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm fresh off my first race of the summer. I'm back from the Salem 6 Hours at the Glen. It was a good weekend up there. Really fun race. A lot of different storylines going on in that race with really all five different classes. A lot of chaos early on in GTP. Ended up with a disqualification in the end to the winning Porsche Penske team. They got disqualified. There's this weird trend with me going to races where there's disqualifications for whatever reason, because I was at the I was at Pocono last year when Denny Hamlin and Kyle Busch, the top two cars, got disqualified. I was at the Loudon Xfinity race last year when two top five cars got disqualified, and Landon Castle and Noah Gregson. So I don't know. I have this weird thing with disqualifications, but fun weekend. In the end, one of the BMW Ray Hall Letterman Lanigan cars ended up winning the race on the fault from the disqualification. They got passed with like 5 minutes to go by the Porsche Penske car, but they ended up winning, so good for them. But really fun race. I had a lot of coverage from there, so if you want to look back at what I was doing over there at Watkins Glen, be sure to check out the articles on the Podium Finish website, and you'll also see the written or the print version of the Mike Rockenfeller interview, which you will hear in a little bit. But very good weekend up there, and now looking forward to getting to the track again in just a couple weeks for my first NASCAR weekend of the summer.
Yes, you are, because you're going to be at New Hampshire Motor Speedway, my home track, my old home track. You've got a quartet this time, so that's going to be pretty fantastic. And then you're heading over to Pocono at the end of July, which at this rate, we have no idea what's going to happen in that race because there could be another disqualification at this rate. And then speaking of disqualification, as you touched upon, Nathan, I'm kind of curious to see what's going to happen with this appeal with the Penske IMSA team. So who knows what's going to happen? Penske and appeals. Crazy stuff happens with them, with motorsports and that. They seem to be around that all every so often each decade. So we'll see what happens with that. And of course, if anything were to change, I'm sure Nathan and the TPF team are going to keep you up to date on that. Well, because we have so much to get to on this edition of TPF Live, let's take the time to hear from our sponsors, SpoilerDiecast.com. Hey, racing fans. Are you in the hunt for the latest diecast cars from Lionel Racing or F1 or IndyCar diecasts? Well, look no further. If you head to SpoilerDiecast.com, you'll find all of the latest and greatest diecast cars and get free shipping and 5% off of your orders if you use promo code TPF by spending $20 or more on your items. Head over to SpoilerDiecast.com and let Evan and his team know that you want the best diecast cards around. And if you use promo code TPF, you'll be in the winner circle. It doesn't get better than that. So just head on over to SpoilerDiecast.com and make your latest purchases today. It is not quite Christmas in July, unless you're in the Southern Hemisphere, like in Australia. And I'm sure if you are listening to us in Australia or New Zealand, well, good day, mate. I wish we had fans in Australia. That would be cool. You should be tuning in from Australia because we have, of course, Shane Van Ginsburg in the Garage 56, Project 91 entry. But hey, getting back on topic, SpoilerDiecast.com has a lot of great new cars from IndyCar, NASCAR, and I'm sure later on this year, the F1 cars are coming along too. Just remember, use promo code TPF, get 5% off, and you'll get free shipping on orders of $20 or more. Evan and his team make sure you get those cars within 3 to 4 business days, which, hey, in this industry, that's hella fast. So head on over to SpoilerDiecast.com, promo code TPF. You'll make me happy. You'll make Evan happy. You'll make yourself happy. So speaking of getting happy, let's go get happy with Podium Perspectives. And I won't say speaking of getting happy because I've said it so many times, but speaking of being quite elated about stuff, let's talk about Ross Chastain and Trackhouse Racing, folks, because let's face it, they've been in the headlines for mostly the wrong reasons. I know they were the points leader for most of the early part of the season, but you know, for a 3-race stretch, they were involved in tanglements with other drivers, you know, to the point that Rick Hendrick had to speak up. Cliff Daniels had enough about it. Kyle Larson, you know, he didn't say anything, but he let his actions be known at Darlington. And folks were saying Ross Chastain's neutered, which is not the case. They were going through a slump. And honestly, it's just kind of perplexing that he hadn't won a race since last year's Geico 500 at Talladega Super Speedway. But let's fast forward to the fact that on Sunday night, the storyline was not about him getting involved in a crash. The storyline was about him and his number one team returning to victory lane at National Super Speedway for their first victory of the season, Ross Chastain's third career cup victory. And oh, by the way, that means he's in the playoffs, folks. But on the other hand, Daniel Suarez and the number 99 team, it's been kind of perplexing for that group as of late. I mean, they were fast off the gate. They had good pace. And it's not to say that they've lost their ways. They're certainly in the hunt, but you would think they'd have a victory by this point in the season, especially with last year when they won at Sonoma, which is, by the way, the last race that they've won in recent times. Now Daniel Suarez finds himself ranked 16th and kind of in a precarious position, whereas Ross Chastain, I would say at this point, Nathan, it's safe for him to be in the playoffs. So we've got a tale of two cities with Trackhouse Racing. So, you know, how big was that victory for Ross and his number one team? And will we see Daniel Suarez return to victory lane at some point?
Yeah, I mean, I guess to start with Ross Chastain, obviously, I mean, a really big victory for sure. Like you mentioned, hadn't been since Hadn't been since April of last year, since the last time he went to Victory Lane. So I guess in a sense, kind of surprised, but like with as much trouble as he's kind of gotten himself in since then, kind of not too. But I mean, on Sunday he ran a great race. I mean, obviously he qualified in the pole. He had the track position to start. And then he ran top five basically all day, had himself in position. That team did a really nice job of keeping up with the track, the change from day to night. And, you know, if they weren't fast before it turned tonight, they were really fast when it turned tonight, because really right after that first set of pit stops, once nightfall came, he just restarted and drove right past the two JGR cars and Denny Hamlin and Martin Truex Jr. and went out to the lead and kept it. So he was probably by far the best car all day. Ran a clean race. I mean, he really had to work for it too. It was not an easy victory. Even though it's going to say he beat Martin Truex Jr. by a couple of seconds, I mean, that lap traffic there towards the end was a real pester for him. He had a couple of really aggressive and tough moves just to, like, get through that lap traffic and, you know, aero block Martin Truex Jr. and put him in a couple of difficult positions where he might have to lift a little bit or just lose that clean air or something where he would lose a little bit of time. So, you know, definitely credit to Ross Chastain. You know, after Darlington and after he wrecked Kyle Larson in those closing restarts, you know, Justin Marks said he had a conversation with him and tried to dial it back a little bit, and then he kind of goes out and has a really not great 5 or 6 week stretch where the results were not there. They were just off on pace. They were not really in contention, not really in the mix. Didn't hear a whole lot about him. But then all of a sudden whatever they were missing, they just found it. So lots of credit to Ross Chastain. And then for Daniel Suarez, I mean, I think he's kind of in, honestly, I think he's in a little bit of a tough position right now. Obviously, anything is still possible. He could out, you know, there's nine more races until the playoffs. He could certainly go and get a win. And I think it's a matter of time until we see him back in victory lane, period. But just the way the last couple months of the season have been playing out, I really don't feel like we're going to really see a whole lot of surprise winners between now and when the playoffs start. I mean, you kind of look at the standings right now, you kind of have just that handful of guys, maybe really only eight different guys that you could say, all right, one of these guys are probably going to win this week. And it's a Martin Truex Jr., a William Byron, a Ross Chastain, a Christopher Bell, Kyle Busch, Denny Hamlin, Kyle Larson, and then I guess you could throw the other two Hendrick cars in there that don't have wins because of the injury situations, and that's Alex Bowman and Chase Elliott. Really, I think any other winner outside of who I just named would be a little bit of a surprise, though I think we probably get one or two more. I think maybe a Kevin Harvick maybe wins here in these next nine races. Either way, he'll be in the playoffs. You know, Chris Buescher has run really, really well this year. I mean, you look at the standings right now, I mean, RFK is 11th and 12th in driver's points right now. They have, in my opinion, they've been the best 14 this season. Certainly been the most consistent. You look at somebody like Tyler Reddick, he's 13th in the points right now, obviously has a win this season, could be a favorite this weekend in Chicago, but his last three starts have been finishes of 30th or worse, so they're not firing on all cylinders right now with a 45 bunch. And then you also see somebody like a Bubba Wallace, who's run pretty well here in the second quadrant here of 2023. He could be a guy that goes out and potentially wins a race. But I think Suarez, he could be a playoff driver for sure. He has a little bit more work to do. Obviously, winning is the most simple way. But if you're looking at guys under the top 16, I think you look at the 200 guys. To potentially go out and win, but I think if somebody like Daniel Suarez can get himself up to maybe 13th or 14th in points, he should have a shot to also potentially point his way into the playoffs as well.
Absolutely. I mean, he's definitely a proven winner. He's a proven contender and champion, of course, with the Xfinity Series, and he knows how to win races or win a race, at least in the Cup Series. And I'll throw some other names into the hat as well. I mean, AJ Allmendinger has suddenly risen from basically obscurity, about 27th place in points after the race at Talladega, and now he's 19th in points, and really, he's only 25 or so points. He's not that far behind 16th place Daniel Suarez. So if they're not going to pick up their performance lately in these next few races, you know, AJ Allmendinger, number 16 colleague racing team, they're more than happy to go ahead and take advantage of that opportunity. So there's so much to look forward to between now and the Daytona regular season finale in late August. So we'll keep our eyes on that, because honestly, I think that's going to be the more intriguing battle until we get to the playoffs, is that battle to get into the final spots in the playoffs. Because I do agree, we're going to have a lot more spots open because of points positions gained and all of that, versus last year where we were like, hey, we're going to get to like 17 different winners or what have you. That's what happens in the second year of a new car. You have a lot of teams and drivers figuring out things, the lay of the land, and no surprise to see who's doing well and who's not doing well. One thing we want to see doing better in NASCAR, of course, is the subject of our second topic, the subject about safety, because a little bit past into the first few laps of stage two, we had a really scary moment involving Ryan Blaney on a restart that was really just a poor situation altogether, where a lot of contact was happening. Ryan Blaney was in the middle of no man's land, got turned. It looked like he was going to be able to slow down and maybe graze the wall, but that car took a sharp left-hand turn and it just pancaked the crap out of that turn one into inside retaining wall, which, by the way, folks, had no safer wall barrier protection. So he felt the brunt of that concrete wall. And yes, folks, I know that there have been a few changes with these cars, especially the season with front end impact, but Blaney was still pretty pissed off, to say the least. I mean, I'm not going to repeat what he said, but let's just say that it wasn't exactly in a I'm going to give you chocolate chip cookies kind of mood about what happened to him, and rightfully so. So, Nathan, I know we talked about this during race day last Sunday about what happened, but how much more work is needed to really improve the safety aspect of NASCAR? Because you would think in 2023, we shouldn't be dealing with this.
Yeah, I mean, look, it shouldn't be a question. If there's a wall on the racetrack, there needs to be a safer barrier. Like, why is there not one there? Like, there's no argument. Like, you can't convince me that there's any spot on any racetrack except for pit road, the pit road wall that the crew members are jumping over. That's the only wall on the racetrack, or inside the hot portion of the racetrack, if you will, that shouldn't have a safer barrier. Like, there's seriously no argument. Like, it's just ridiculous, man. Like, he obviously Blaney spun there and he hit the wall really hard. And I mean, by the naked eye, you could say, oh, it looks like so-and-so is hit the wall harder. Oh, you know, this driver hit the wall 190 miles per hour head-on. Blaney only hit it at 80 or 90. Well, again, he hit a concrete wall. There's no give. There's no resistance. There's no nothing. I mean, if you imagine, you know, crashing a street car against a concrete wall at 90 miles an hour, I don't think that'd feel particularly good either. That's obviously a problem. There's no excuse for it. There needs to be safer barriers everywhere. And I think just about every driver that I've heard comment on it is just about agreed. When they go back there next year, there needs to be safer barriers there, but there should have been some there in the first place. I mean, when we talk about safety, I mean, you don't want to have to have any safety concerns at all, but I'd rather, like, being concerned about a wall should be so 10 years ago. Like, you shouldn't have to, like, we shouldn't be having to have these conversations anymore of, oh, there should have been a safer barrier there, because if there's not safer barriers, they will find them. They will. NASCAR said that they're going to evaluate after the race like they always do, and sure, I get that, but at this point, it shouldn't be a debate. You have to put safer barriers everywhere, end of story. Like, there's no excuse for it. There's nothing in this sport, or really any sport, that trumps safety. And if you're NASCAR, there's no there's no ceiling in terms of the money that they're going to pay in terms of safety to make that the sport safer. That budget's unlimited. So yeah, there needs to be safe barriers everywhere.
110% on that. I mean, like you said, this is 2023. We shouldn't even have this conversation anymore. And it shouldn't have to take a driver hitting a section of the track that nobody suspected a crash to occur for a safer barrier to be raised or put there for the following race, whether it's later in the season or next year. It should just be, oh, wait a second, we haven't covered this yet. We've got to put something here. Yes, there is no ceiling. There is no, oh, it's too much money. We've got to keep working on that, whether that's improving the cars from impacts or the wall, safer barriers, protecting these exposed walls. Fans don't want to see their favorite drivers get hurt. Even competitors who may not stand or tolerate their fellow rival on the track, I think they would rather go and deal with the angst and frustration of that driver on the track versus them being in the hospital or being sidelined from injury. There has to be a better way of going about this, and it shouldn't take a crash to raise attention on that. So we're hopeful that, National Super Speedway improves upon that, and every other track does some soul searching immediately so that this is not a topic that we have on the show. And in fact, if there is a crash, we know that they've hit the safer barrier. Yes, it's scary, but we've done everything we can to protect the drivers from any further harm, other than being angry, which will take over them being hurt. Now, for our penultimate topic on TPF Live, this is an interesting storyline, to say the least. So, as you fans may be aware of, we're heading into the final year of the current TV contract next season. So there's been a lot of conversations behind the scenes about which television partners and streaming partner will NASCAR work with once we head into 2025 and beyond. And the TV deal is more than just what channels fans are going to tune into to watch the next race. It's also going to impact purses, distribution of money, the economics of our sport. Because let's face it, it's not quite the same as it was 10 years ago, much less during the heydays of the late 90s. So, long story short, John Ireland of the Sports Business Journal reported that it looks like Fox and NBC are still going to be the TV partners for now, with Amazon emerging as a potential streaming partner for at least a midsummer section of the season, similar to what TNT had from 2007 to about 2014. You may remember this, folks. Fox had, the first several races of the season. Then TNT had the middle section, and then ESPN and ABC finished off the fall and the summer races. So in this case, Nathan, it's interesting to note that unlike what happened in 2007, we may still have the same partners. I know we have different opinions about these partners, which is totally okay, by the way. But I mean, what are your thoughts about, NASCAR modernizing its ways to broadcast races, and what can be done to make the coverage better?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's good though that NASCAR will still stay on, national linear television. I mean, obviously, I think NASCAR has to push for as many races on broadcast television as possible. Like, they need as many races as possible on Big Fox and Big NBC, not FS1 and USA Network, because obviously, Fox and NBC have more reach than those other channels. More people will be watching, more people will be tuning in, more advertising, all of that. And in this day and age, there also have to be, whether it's on Fox, NBC, there also have to be streaming alternatives. Like, I'd love to see every NBC race, whether it's on NBC or USA Network, Xfinity or Cup. I'd love to see all of that also be available on Peacock, and then a similar alternative as well on the Fox side, have everything on national television, but also people be able to stream it as well. So then there's options. For the Amazon thing, I think it could definitely work out. I think I've said this before on here. Obviously, a lot of the people that watch NASCAR are a bit of an older generation, so it might take a little bit of adjusting for sure. More people are going to have to maybe pay for Amazon Prime, but the NFL made that switch last year, and it seemed to have been really successful. So I think NASCAR said, well, if the NFL can do it and they can be really successful from it, why can't we, so I think it certainly it seems pretty inevitable that at least some portion of the TV deal will be on Amazon. But yeah, there needs to be streaming alternatives really for every single race, regardless whether on national TV or not. And like you mentioned, it's more than just where we're gonna watch the races. It's the economics of the whole sport. I mean, this is essentially our CBA, basically, revenue sharing. And if they get this right, it could lead to like more people, not trying to stray too far from the actual TV portion of it, but like it could lead to more talented drivers having opportunities in NASCAR versus more funded drivers. And that obviously became a little bit of a topic of debate with Josh Berry going to Stewart Haas Racing, something that we talked about last week. Obviously, Josh Berry, he's a guy that came up through the ranks, did late models, did the Cars Tour, got that opportunity with Junior Motorsports on the Xfinity side after racing late models there for so long, took advantage of it, obviously. But he never had that funding like a lot of these other drivers, and now he's going to Cup. So I think the hope is now that with this new TV deal, if they get it right, we'll see more guys that get opportunities in the top levels of NASCAR, based off of their skill versus them just bringing a primary sponsorship in with them. So, a lot has to do with this TV deal, and it's obviously very crucial that NASCAR gets it right.
Yes, we want to see them make it be the best of both worlds for everybody because, we want to see more of the Josh Berrys make it to NASCAR. We want to be able to have fans be mostly happy about what the telecasts are like. You're still not going to please everybody, of course, but certainly the debates that should be happening is which announcing team is better. What do I like about the scoreboard versus complaining about commercials, start times, certain things about the telecast that honestly has nothing to do with the race, the race itself. It's just the race experience. So, with 2025 comes around, I'm just curious to see if these same players are going to be involved. Some networks may have a lot more work to do versus others, but in the end, we want to see a good product presenting this sport because if there isn't, if the sport has great competition, but the folks that are depicting this on our TVs or the radio, what have you, your phone, if they're not going to be great, you're not going to engage new fans. I'm not saying it's the end all be alls of how to get new fans, but honestly, as a kid, I loved ESPN. That's how I got in, really hooked into motorsports. Then I eventually got into IndyCar and all kinds of other racing series, but pretty much my heart belongs to NASCAR and IndyCar in terms of when I was a kid because of great TV coverage. So it's a different time. I realize that, but let's hopefully see something that benefits everybody and especially the fans and the competitors so that we don't eliminate good talents from making it into the sport. Well, for our last topic, you know what time it is, folks. It's winning time here. And we don't really have to tell you about past winners for this one because there is no past winners for the Loop 121 and the Grand Prix 220 NASCAR races at the Chicago Street Course. What we can tell you, though, is this racetrack was born out of an iRacing event that took place 2 years ago. Yes, folks, you may remember when FS1 did those Wednesday night races. Kind of as a substitute for midweek races at, oh, please, let's not ever have any midweek races for NASCAR. But anyways, folks, back to the topic. Let's just get to it. Let's get to it, Nathan. Let's name our picks to win the Loop 121 Xfinity race and our Grand Parc 220 NASCAR Cup Series race, because again, we ain't got no past winners.
Yeah, first of all, it's kind of weird that we actually have NASCAR races that aren't sponsored corporately. Like, we usually have, such and such 200 or whatever, but it's kind of cool, a little bit of a traditional type deal with the race naming. I wish I had any clue about either of these races, because I really have no idea which way to go. Obviously, this course is going to be really tight. Nobody really knows a whole lot about it. I think it's going to be a lot about survival and attrition and strategy, because I don't think passing is going to be very easy. So I think there's definitely going to be a lot of emphasis on qualifying and turning a clean lap there. On the Xfinity side, oh man. On the Xfinity side, I'll go Josh Berry. He's the type of guy that he might not be the best road course racer, but he knows how to survive. And he puts himself maybe not in positions to win on those road courses. But he gets like top five after top five after top five because he's smart about how he runs those races. So I think in a race like that could be all about survival. I think that could fit him really well. So we'll go Josh Berry. And then on the Cup side, I'll pick a little bit of a surprise winner here. I'll go Michael McDowell. He's another type, another guy that has quietly run pretty well this year, having another pretty good year for Front Row Motorsports. He's a very good road course racer and is one of the few guys in the field that has street course experience. They're in a position where I think that team is willing to take risks to maybe give him the track position he needs to go out and win a race. So I'll go Michael McDowell.
Those are some solid picks you gave, considering the fact that we're doing this without any clue as to how these races are going to be run, other than that iRacing event from 2021, and of course the eNASCAR Coca-Cola Series held a race at the virtual version of that track on Tuesday night, which was not that bad. But yes, to your point, Nathan, passing is going to be quite the challenge with this track. Now, of course, this track is really on the streets of Chicago. It's not, we're in Chicago, but we're like in Joliet. This is an actual real deal, real McCoy kind of situation. And of course, this is going to be a track that goes around the famous Buckingham Fountain through the Lakefront Green, all the way around basically the, really cool part of Chicago. Near the art museum where I believe Ferris Bueller was filmed in 1985. And then, of course, back to the front straightaway. So I think really, I'm not a driver, but just looking at the track layout here, Nathan, I think the best passing opportunities are going to be, turn one, if you get that good straightaway draft, from another driver with these diffusers. And then the only other section I think a passing opportunity can happen will be just after turn five, going into turn six. Otherwise, folks, it's about qualifying really well. So for the Xfinity Loop 121, I'm going to go with a really safe pick here, folks. I'm going with a number 10 Colic Racing entry of Justin Marks, who is the all-star driver, the trophy-hunting driver that Colic has elected to go with, because, of course, NASCAR is not allowing any Cup drivers from competing in the Xfinity race. So Justin Marks for the victory, because I saw what he did, well, remotely. I saw what he did remotely with the street course race in Detroit in the TA2 race. And yeah, he's a hell of a driver. And of course, he did a really good job last weekend in the Trans Am race, finishing in the podium at Mid-Ohio. As far as the Cup Series race is concerned, this is not one of those times I'll say a Hendrick car or, a Joe Gibbs car. Unless they qualify well. But kind of staying on the theme I talked about earlier about A.J. Allmendinger rising to the occasion in recent weeks, I really think that the number 16 Colic Racing entry has what it takes to win at the Chicago Street Course. A.J. does a great job on road courses. And hey, let's not forget, before he was in NASCAR, he raced on street courses in the Champ Cars in the mid-2000s. So I look for a little bit of a throwback victory, if you will, for Mr. Allmendinger when it comes to Sunday's Grand Park 220. But as always, folks, please tell us what you think. Do you think that we're right? Do you think you have different picks in mind that you'd like to share with us? You should tweet to us because Nathan is at NSolly02. I'm at Rob Tiongson. And for the whole team, it's at the podium finish. So tweet to us if you happen to have the winning combination for this weekend's races. I will personally purchase you a in-stock 2023 164 car from spoilerdadcast.com. That's how we do around here, folks. And anyways, I think we're heading to one of the best segments of our podcast, In the Hot Seat. Now, for this week's edition, we have had three interviews. That's right, three interviews for you folks. So I'm going to defer to Nathan for the first one because this one's the most recent, freshest one, and probably it's a really good get for us. So Nathan, why don't you tell the folks at home about your hot seat contributions for this week?
Yeah, for sure. So when I was up at Watkins Glen, I was able to speak with Mike Rockefeller. He, of course, participated in the Garage 56 entry for Hendrick Motorsports out in Le Mans. So I was very fortunate to be able to talk to him just about that experience in general of doing that race and being like the first stock car to participate, the first NASCAR stock car to participate in a race, an endurance race like that. So without further ado, let's roll into it. Mike Rockefeller here on phase one of today's hot seat.
So just to start, you know, I know you've done a lot of races over in Le Mans before. Just what was your overall experience like, though, working with Hendrick Motorsports and the Garage 56 entry?
Honestly, one of the best in my life as a whole. So the team, the whole preparation, the execution, the spirit, the car, the vibe around it, my teammates, it was just great, crazy to be part of it. And last year in March, when I heard about the project and Sebring, and I knew I will do the development, I didn't know at the time if I will race the car or not. I never expected something like that. But then I grew into it and I understood the partners involved, and then I also understood how big it is, when I heard the teammates and so on. So it was a very cool experience I don't want to miss, even though it's very different to all the years, where all my other years in Le Mans you fight in a category, even overall or in class, GT or whatever, for victory against the others, which here that was the only thing we were missing a little bit. But it was still, we had the goal to race the clock and to race, you know, as high in the ranks as we could. Unfortunately, we had the transmission issue, which put us down a little bit. Yeah.
And what was that process like of becoming involved with Garage 56? How did you get approached to do this, drive this car?
Well, I was, as you know, racing at the time, or maybe you don't know, I was racing with Action Express in the 48 car. So already there, Hendrick was involved, and Action. And those two, Action at the very, very beginning, started to build the very first cup car to test tires. And they asked me, very simple, and then it didn't take me that long to say yes.
Is there anything that car could compare to? Like, is there anything similar that you've driven to before?
Well, I would say in a way, it's not far away from a GT at all, as you could see also from lap time. It's a bit heavier, it's a bit more power, so that those two things are different. But I have to say the way it drove, not only in Le Mans, but also in all the preparation, was pretty impressive. And it was just fun, you know, the balance was nice, it gives you a nice window, it's not crazy tricky, it's very honest, and you have to muscle it around. I feel it's a real man's car, and the sound is awesome, and you know, everything about it was just cool.
Now,
but for sure, we did a few updates on it from the standard cup car, but at the end it was still a cup car. We just, you know, try to make it a bit faster, a bit more efficient for Le Mans.
And you made those cup starts. You made a start here. You made a start at the Roval. How much did that help? Was it similar?
Well, no. It was, well, yeah, yes and no. I mean, a cup race, I think it's something on its own. Not only because the car was a little different at the end, but just because the race, how it unfolds and so on, endurance race with driver changes, it's very different. So, but for me, that the cup races were great to experience. I'm thankful to have had the opportunity to do it, but it was just nice to understand. I always looked up to NASCAR in my whole life and career, and again, I was like a little kid, you know, on Christmas when I knew about it. And then, of course, to be with Hendrick after my cup experience with Spire, as you can imagine, that's a different level.
What was the general reaction from everybody over in Le Mans just seeing that car?
Very positive, not only from the fans, they were loving it, the sound, the look, the pace, everything. Everybody was happy about it, but also in the whole paddock. I think we gained a lot of respect the way we ran the car. And that was, for me, that was actually the most impressive, that no matter who of the OEMs or whatever, you know, bosses, drivers, mechanics, engineers, everybody I know in the paddock came up and was like, man, this is so impressive. So it was, I think, overall a success.
Were you surprised at all with the pace of that car being, you know, it was really the first time doing sports car racing?
No, I mean, I did all the development, so I knew what was coming. Of course, you don't know it to the last second. But we were in the area what we wanted to be, where we wanted to be, what we worked for so hard. So I was not completely surprised.
Obviously, like you said, it was its own car, own class, so not really directly competing against anybody. But you guys were just as quick as all the GTE cars and pacing those cars until that driveline issue. So what exactly happened there, and how cool is this to be in front of all those cars?
Well, we, as you know, we did testing and endurance tests before, and we never had that issue. So that's a little bit of a bummer, but it was nice. That was the idea. Our goal was to overcome the, let's say, the deficit on pit stops or changing more tires than them and so on, on pace, on track, and we did. So we were leading the GTs, and then, I mean, that's why you want to race in Le Mans. It's a huge race, and you know, it always has been one of the toughest races for the material, and unfortunately we had that issue, which made us, we had to change the gearbox to finish the race, and that cost a lot of time. But yeah, that's what it is, right? I mean, you can prepare and prepare and prepare, and you feel safe. Like I said, we never ever had an issue before with the gearbox, and it just happened to be. And I don't know any further analyses if they looked into it and maybe what was happening exactly. It just happened out of the blue. I don't know, 4.5 hours before the end, and nevertheless, we finished, which is great.
And like you said, I kind of sidelined you guys for about an hour, but the number one goal for you guys was to finish the race. You guys were on the track at the very end, so how fulfilling was it to just achieve that goal?
That was definitely nice. We were a bit sad with the issue to lose so much time, but again, the team overcame this problem, and they changed the gearbox way faster than we expected to, because we were not sure if we can make it until the finish. And they definitely made it. And we went out there. I did the quickest race lap right after. You know, the car was in perfect condition. Everything was great. And that shows, again, how good the team is. And at the end, everybody was happy. You know, Mr. Hendrick was there, Mr. Franz, Jeff Gordon, all the drivers, the whole team, Chad Knaus, Craig, our engineer, our crew chief, everybody of the team, every mechanic. I mean, I'm so proud of them. It's a bit sad, you know, to go away and basically not work together anymore, probably for the rest of our life. But it was definitely something I will look back with a lot of joy, probably more than many other things I did in my career.
Obviously, you've worked with Jimmy and Chad before, but to be able to share a car with a guy like Jenson Button, how neat was that?
That was super cool. I mean, I knew him before. We always had a little bit of contact, and we raced against each other in the DTM. One race, and then we stayed in touch, and when I knew that there's a chance he's on the car, I thought it's the perfect fit for the program, and it turned out that it was. Jimmy, of course, being Jimmy Johnson, and then Jenson Button, world champion in Formula One, super fast, very competitive, British humor, perfect.
And then what do you think is next for Garage 56? Do you think it's a one and done, or do you think it'll be...
No, it's a one and done.
Completely one and done?
Yeah.
don't think there'll be any other stock car division in Le Mans.
Not that I know of. Not really, not.
And then for you, you know, obviously you've been in stock cars a little bit now the last year. Do you hope to increase your involvement in stock car racing, or do you think that'll be it for
you? It's not something I think about. I probably think that's it. But of course, if somebody wants me, I'm always available, and I'm happy to join and jump in. But right now I'm focused on IMSA with a Porsche 963 with JDC, and then see what happens for next year.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Mike Rockenfeller in the hot seat for phase one of three for our beloved segment here on TPF Live. And now I get the middle and final parts of our interview. So for this particular interview, we're going to talk to an up-and-coming rising driver from the Team Hornady Development Camp. By the way, thank you, Taylor Kitchen, for making this possible. And in fact, for the next several weeks, we are going to feature a different Team Hornady Development driver to have you fans at home learn more about them, about their career, their journey, everything. So in this case here, I had the pleasure to speak with Landon Lewis, who, of course, is the points leader as of right now in the ARCA Menards West Series. He recently won the race at Portland International Raceway in a rather spirited duel against Cole Custer, and we were fortunate enough to get him not too long after that victory at Portland. Got to learn about why he's in racing, what he's learned from the Hornadays, and really his aspirations when it comes to racing. So without further ado, for phase two of the hot seat, here is Landon Lewis. Welcome back to another edition of The Hot Seat here on the Putty Finish Live. I'm Rob Tiongson, and on this edition of Hot Seat, we have a young but sensationally talented driver joining us for this segment. That driver, of course, is making his way through the ARCA Menards West Series, and he is driver the number 17 ARCA entry, and that is Landon Lewis. He is the most recent winner at Portland after that exciting battle with Cole Custer. So lots to talk about on this edition of Hot Seat. So before we get started, Landon, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How about you?
It's great. As of this recording, we're doing it on a Friday, so I can't complain when it's Friday.
Yes, for sure.
Now, I did some reading about your career and watched your races, of course, since you've come up through the national ranks, but I was really taken aback when I saw that you started your career at the age of four. I was like, man, I don't remember even thinking about a lifelong passion at that age. But what do you recall about those early days racing in go-karts and what, you know, working your way through motorsports?
Yes, I definitely been a journey for sure. And like you said, at 4 years old, like you really didn't know, like that was a dream, right? Or you didn't really like know what you really wanted to do. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do either. I just, being around racing all my life, my dad raced, my grandparents raced. So being around the racetrack all my life from the time I was born, it kind of really, I guess, gave me no option that I had to go do that just because it's kind of all I know, all I've known at since that age. I started racing when I was four, and then my dad kind of hung up his helmet and started helping me out. And ever since then, it's just been an amazing journey. And I'm grateful for everything that's come with this a dream and an amazing journey for sure.
You've been having a really amazing journey, to say the least. I mean, we'll get to the fun part, which is where you're at right now. But I mean, in those formative years, I'm just like thinking again, like going so fast in a go-kart. I mean, these are not like amusement park go-karts, I would imagine. These are the ones that zip through a racetrack a quarter mile or so, like the small tracks. Yep. So quickly. So, I mean, when you competed in go-karts during those first 8 years of your career, I know you were successful and to the point that your dad was getting in touch with Ron Hornaday Jr. to build your first dirt modified car, which I, as I understand, Ron's one of your mentors, as a matter of fact. So, you know, how pivotal was that moment when your dad was like, hey, Mr. Hornaday, I think we got to get my son in a dirt modified car, and also knowing that, hey, he's going to be one of your mentors and he's one of your heroes too.
Yeah. Like you said, we had really good success running go-karts, and I really didn't know about the connection with Ron Hornaday at the time, just because my dad was kind of keeping it on the down low a little bit until I guess it kind of finally come true. But I was actually coming up to Mooresville, North Carolina for a banquet that I had won in go-karts. And my dad was like, oh, we're going to make a stop at a shop. And I'm like, okay. So, you know, we pulled up to the shop. I'm like, what's this, right? I just see it's a race shop. And so we walked inside and there was standing Ron Hornaday, and my dad broke the news to me that we're going to be buying a dirt modified from him. And, you know, just buying it and going racing and just learning that the bigger cars. So went racing a couple times. My second time ever, Ron actually come to the track and watched me. And I guess from there on, he seen something in me that I didn't really see at the time. And so he told me that he's seen something in me that was really special. And ever since then, he's just been a huge help in my career and just been really huge to have him as a mentor, just because he has so much knowledge about the sport. He's very well respected in the sport. So being able to ask him questions on and off the racetrack is a huge advantage to me.
That's a huge, huge praise for someone like him to notice something in you that you're obviously starting to realize and fulfilling as a young driver. I mean, you're only, 16, 17 years old, which blows my mind that you were born in the year 2006. That's a running gag, by the way. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We make fun of the fact that I'm becoming the old young journalist. But anyways, no, it's just so cool because I followed a lot of what Ron did in the truck series, obviously. And curious, did he teach you some of his restart tricks? Because he was Mr. Restart back in the day.
Yeah, he's got some tricks up his sleeve. He's taught me a couple of them. A couple of them I don't think I could do anymore, just because I don't think NASCAR or any series would allow that. But yeah, he's definitely taught me some secrets, and he's just not even the restarts, just the racecraft and how to control a situation is just, he's helped me the most at.
Oh yeah. If you could not have had a better mentor in this sport. And that's just it's a high praise. And that's why I think you are one of the more intriguing young drivers coming up the stock car ladder. And, you know, obviously you're making a lot of noise in ARCA West. You've done so already in go-karts, dirt modifieds, even legends cars. And I understand you participated in the summer shootout series at Charlotte Motor Speedway, which is a huge proving ground series that a lot of NASCAR alumni cut their teeth in. So, I mean, what has it been like to transition from each of these vehicles and pick up all the nuances as you've progressed your way in your career?
It's been a learning experience just because, you know, there's so many different types of cars that I've drove. You know, a stock car's really big, a dirt modified's big. Then you have a legend car that, you know, you can see all four tires from sitting, and you sit in the middle of the car. And then you have a go-kart, which is low to the ground, really small. So I've done a lot of different things in my career, and it's been really cool to be able to learn the different things and learning how, you know, the stock cars drive. You know, they're really heavy and really slow movements. The legend cars are really fast. Everything's like really fast happening, and your mind has to be really sharp. So there's been some learning curves along the way of learning the different cars I'm driving, but it's been really fun to learn them. And I can't hopefully here soon I can learn a different car.
Certainly. I mean, I think it's such a great asset for you to have these different experiences. I mean, the go-karts obviously teach you those reflexes, like you mentioned. And I have to imagine, too, driving the dirt modified, you know, to some folks, they may not understand why would you go from asphalt to all of a sudden a really slick kind of surface in a race car. But, you know, for those who may not understand that concept, why is it so valuable to get experience in a dirt modified or any kind of dirt track car?
It just teaches you car control, mostly car control, how to adapt to a racetrack fast. Just because, you know, when you go dirt racing, it's not like you get a full day of practice or 2 hours of practice. You get three laps of practice straight to qualifying, straight to a race. So everything's really fast movement. So I feel like it helps you with just adapting to a new racetrack really fast and being able to just, like I said, adapt fast. And then your team, you can improve as the day goes on in the bigger stock cars because you do get a little bit more practice. So if you as a driver can adapt to the racetrack fast, then you could start focusing on the setup of the car to make it a little better. So if you look at like Kyle Larson, right? Kyle Larson is probably one of the best NASCAR drivers at this time right now. And I feel like he's one of the best just because he's so good at, you know, breaking down his car, letting him know when it's loose and tight because of his dirt experience and being able to adapt to a new racetrack that he goes to. So, you know, I feel like it just teaches you car control, how to control the situation and just different racetracks you go to.
That's some great insights for sure, because it's more than just, you know, putting holding a pretty wheel and you know, putting your right foot on the throttle. Of course, you got to do all those other nuances to succeed in this sport. And if you don't, you're obviously going to get dusted by the competition. So it's interesting to hear, you know, why it's so important. And it just seems like a lot of the top drivers today have had some kind of pedigree on dirt track racing. So I think it's going to come into play for you. And, you know, obviously, as you work your way through the ARCA West Series, I'm imagining you're eyeing towards the national ARCA level or even the top three of NASCAR. You know, if you got the opportunity to race at some of those historic tracks, I mean, how much are you licking your chops knowing like, hey, I actually got the experience. I may actually have the advantage over these veterans and these younger drivers.
I think it's cool, right? Like you mentioned, you know, licking your chops going to these new racetracks, just because any new racetrack is awesome to go to, just because it's a new learning experience. You test your abilities to be able to adapt to the racetrack, to be fast around a certain racetrack, because every racetrack in the country is a little bit different in some way or form. So it definitely, I feel like, gives you a little bit of advantage. You know, as you can tell, a lot of NASCAR drivers nowadays are racing dirt. You know, they're running a micro, they're running dirt late models, they're running all kinds of stuff on the dirt surface, because I feel like they've seen, you know, these dirt drivers coming into NASCAR and how good they really are. So I feel like it's kind of opened their eyes a little bit to dirt racing is a very hard sport. And if you can get it, you can really be good on an asphalt. So I think it definitely gives you a little bit of advantage for sure.
And it's great that you're picking up on the setup side of things, because a lot of, I don't know if it's fair to say this, but some folks get the impression that younger drivers are just all about the car, like driving the car. They don't focus on the characteristics, giving good feedback. But I've just been talking to you the last 7 minutes, and I'm like, yeah, if I were your crew chief, you would probably help me figure out how to fix your car. So I'm glad you're dispelling that notion, because I feel like drivers like you are obviously like, hey, put the brakes on that notion, folks. I do pay attention to this stuff.
It's important to pay attention to those kind of things, because the car is never going to be perfect. You know, every race you race, every win and when you get, it's never going to be perfect. So you got to learn how to figure out what's wrong with the car. If it's the front acting up, is it the rear? Like, what part of the car is the problem? And it helps your crew chief to be able to make an adjustment faster, where you're not kind of chasing the car all day long. So I feel like it helps you a lot being able to know, you know, the different parts of your car. And if it wasn't for, you know, because Ron, when I first met him, he made sure I was in the shop with him working on the car. If I wrecked it, I had to fix it. So he always told me, you have to learn how to work on your car and what's going on underneath your why, you know, because obviously holding the wheel pretty, hitting the gas, it's all of it, like obviously really, really easy, but you have to learn what's going on in all four corners of your car to be really, really good and really fast. So I feel like knowing that gives, you know, you and your team a really good communication level. And it also, I feel like, helps with like, what am I trying to say? Like, it helps you with, you know, if you do wreck your car, you know how much effort it takes to get the car back on the racetrack. So you learn how much your guys really do mean to you and how much, if it wasn't for them, you know, you wouldn't be at the track every weekend. So I feel like the level of respect there is better too within your team.
I am so glad that you mentioned that, because that was actually one of my questions. So I feel like you may have seen this list in advance, which you did not, by the way, but no, that's interesting you say that, because of course, I'm sure you're observing this as a driver yourself, you know, namely Kyle Busch has been calling out the lack of respect on the track in the Cup Series and the other top three series in NASCAR. And as a young driver here, you're saying, hey, I'm having to fix my own car if I wreck this sucker. So, I mean, is that one of the things, I don't know if it's like a thing that Ron's saying, you got to do this, but would you say it's even innate in yourself to say, man, I better respect what I'm doing, because I could easily, you know, lose this opportunity if I'm just bang banging into other people and I don't give a care what happens?
Well, yeah, that plays a part into it, but I think it's like we mentioned, the level of respect between you and the guy you're racing beside or the guy you're racing around, it makes you, when you're rubbing or beating and banging or you're wrecking somebody, it makes you go back and think like, all right, this is going to take an hour's worth of work. This is going to take a full day's worth of work, right? For your team. So if you don't know how much effort it really takes to get the car to the racetrack every weekend, you're going to just go in there and door slam somebody or just run them up the racetrack because you don't know how much effort and how much work it takes to get the car to the racetrack that next weekend. So if you do know that, it makes you think a little bit before you make a stupid mistake or something stupid. So I feel like we said, it makes you just understand what's going on and how much effort it takes to get the car to the racetrack and how much your team makes a difference getting the car to the track every weekend.
Well, I just love the fact that you're a lot different in that regard. And I think that's going to go a long ways for you once you make it to the Cup Series, which, yes, I'm not making that prediction. I know it's a matter of fact for you because you're certainly proving yourself in stock cars. And let's actually talk about that right now. You know, your amazing start to the ARCA West season. You got that victory, like I said, in that last lap battle with Cole Custer, which was super exciting. And, you know, listening to Charles Kroll's call, I was just like, man, this is like the classic race. And it was. And then you're leading the points after these first several races. So, I mean, how delighted are you about the start to 2023, especially with that victory at Portland?
2023, honestly, has been a really good year for me. Obviously, we've only got one win so far, but we've been super consistent as a team. We finished second 4 times in a row on 3 on the east, or 3 on the west, 1 on the east. So we've had speed every time we've unloaded, and we've been in the fight to win every race. I mean, we've led a lap in every single race that we've been in this year. So I wouldn't hang my head at all about 2023 because, I mean, it's just been a great year. We've had really good speed, like I mentioned. We finally got a win at Portland against some really good cars. So, I mean, 2023, it's just been awesome for sure. And I can't wait to see what stands at the end of the year for sure.
Yeah, because you've got a lot of options, I'm sure. And winning in front of all of those NASCAR Xfinity Series owners doesn't hurt as well, because
no,
I'm sure that
it definitely doesn't hurt for sure.
Because I'm sure they were watching that race, and man, you put on a hell of a show for the fans, and I'm sure those drivers are like, man, this kid's the real deal. If they didn't think that, I'm sure they're thinking about that now. Now, I know you're still a very young driver, but I'm sure this question does apply to you. What would you consider to be your welcome to stock car racing moment that makes you laugh or smile when you talk about it?
Well, man, I've made some mistakes in my stock car career so far. I think the biggest one, I think Dover sticks out to me really bad because, I mean, obviously we finished second. It was a great day. First time ever at a racetrack that fast, that much banking. No practice, no qualifying. We finished second. We led laps. So Dover sticks out to me because the mistake I made, I feel like if I didn't make that mistake of, you know, pinching him into turn 3 and kind of getting and hitting him and washing up the racetrack, I think if I wouldn't have made that mistake, I wouldn't have won the race and brought home the Monster Trophy. So that race kind of, it makes me laugh a little bit because it's like, I should know better to do that. But then it's also like, all right, next year, if I go back, now I know what to do, and hopefully we can finish one spot better. So there's a little bit of laughing going involved in that answer because, you know, I should have known better to do that. At the same time, though, I'm kind of hard on myself a little bit because I was, you know, that close from getting the win.
It's understandable. And, you know, it's something to think about that after the fact, but I'm sure in the moment you're just like, Landon, this is the right move. I've got to do this. And now you're like, oh my God, that's what a rookie move I made, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was just because, you know, we had a restart with 3 to go. Not thinking about this. I mean, like every race I've been involved this year in and finished second or one, there's been like last lap shootouts. So going into that, I'm like, all right, I already know kind of what to do just because, I mean, I've been involved in them like 3 times already. And so we took the green and I held it on the outside, which is really hard at Dover. Considering, you know, we were the first race on the racetrack. The bottom is obviously way better because the rubber hasn't moved up the racetrack yet at Dover. So, you know, I kind of stuck it on the outside for 2 laps straight. I mean, side by side with Jake Finch. So it was really cool and a really good race. But, you know, like you said, that you're like, I got out of the car and the first thing I said, Ron walked up to me. He's like, heck of a job, dude. Like, that was the best race I've seen you drove. And I'm like, no, it was not. Like, I should have won this race. Like, that was such a rookie move. So, I mean, it was laughing, but like I said, I'm a little hard on myself just because I know that I shouldn't make those mistakes.
But that's good though, because if you feel like you could have done better, that's because you probably will do better next time. And that's good to have that hunger within you, because as long as it's that competitive fire is there, you absolutely are going to have a really long career in racing. So I love that. That's a great response to that question that I have typically asked through my journalism career for sure. This is kind of a jokey question, but a serious one too. You know, you come from the East Coast, but yet a lot of your inspirations happen to be from the West Coast, and Ron, of course, and Kevin Harvick as well. You talked about Ron being such a huge instrumental force with your career, but I'm just kind of wondering how Kevin Harvick inspired you in your journey so far.
Kevin Harvick, I mean, growing up as a kid, I mean, obviously watching NASCAR on the TV on Sundays, and you see him race, and I just, from that point, I mean, it was like really cool to see him race just because of how hard he drives hard every lap. You know, he doesn't take any crap from anyone. So I like that of him. And then what really, like, obviously I liked him growing up as a kid. That was my favorite NASCAR driver. But, you know, working in Mooresville, North Carolina with Joe Ryan Race Cars on my Legend Car team, you know, Keelan Harvick actually drives for us now. So what was really cool was, you know, Ron knew Kevin. Kevin slept on Ron's couch, the whole deal. You know, he moved from California, come here, got a ride, made to Cup Series. But that relationship, you know, Kevin comes to the shop that one day, and I was able to meet him face-to-face the first time ever. And I kind of look back and I'm like, wow, that was really, really cool to meet someone that I've looked up to for a long time just by watching TV. I never got to meet him, but just watching him on TV is someone that inspired me. And then I was finally be able to meet him, and just being around him in the last 6 months has just been really cool for me, because I've learned so much from him of how much it takes to be the one of the best drivers in NASCAR, and how much effort it takes every day of your life to perform the best you can on Sundays. So being around him has just been awesome for me. And it's just been really cool, a learning experience.
That's really awesome to know that Kevin is that down to earth. He's approachable. He's someone that definitely authentically fueled your career for sure. And there's a saying that you shouldn't be meeting your heroes, but it sounds like in this case, it was well worth meeting one of your heroes, to say the least.
Yeah, it was definitely well worth meeting him, just because of, you know, how great he is, obviously, in NASCAR. And he's one of the best for sure. And how down to earth, like you mentioned, you know, he loves the fans. He loves talking to people. He'll help anyone out. You know, he gave me his number and was like, hey, call me whenever you need me. If you're going to a racetrack that you're not sure about and that I've been to, give me a call and I'll give you tips for it. So being able to have, you know, that one click away for him to answer on the phone is just, you can't put a price on that. And same for Ron, just because he's one of the greats too. So being able to, you know, just pick up my phone, type his name in, hit call on both of them is just priceless. And I can't thank them enough for everything.
That's awesome. I just love how both of them are giving back to the sport that they've done so much for throughout their career. And it's no surprise, when I was reading up about you and your career, you have a thing on your bio that says, hey, I like to pay it forward too. And it sounds like when you're in the opportunity, in that position to give back to racing, you are going to do the same thing that Ron and Kevin have done for you. So it's so cool to see this circle of life happen in NASCAR. I just love it. It's so cool.
Yeah, it's definitely cool. And like you mentioned, you read obviously on my website of how I like to give back to the kids mostly. Obviously, I work here at Joe Ryan Race Cars and work on my Legend car and work on other people's Legend cars. But being able to go to the track, you mentioned the summer shootout this year. I'm not racing the summer shootout, but I'm there every week helping the drivers out, helping kids, driver coaching them, watching their GoPro footage, and just trying to make them the best they can be when they go on the racetrack. So I love helping kids out, pursue their dreams as much as I like helping mine, just because it's really cool to see a kid progress and get better every single time he hits the racetrack. And one of those are Keelan Harvick, Kevin's son. He's very, very, very talented, which he should be, obviously, because his dad's Kevin Harvick. But he's just very talented, very focused. And it's been a true pleasure to work with him, just because of how much, you know, it's taught me a lot too, working with him, just because of, you know, his knowledge. He has a lot of knowledge for 10 years old. So he's definitely going to be one to force to reckon with in the future. But it's just been really cool to work with these younger drivers and help them as much as I can.
Jeez, he's 10 already. Man, yeah.
I remember watching him on NASCAR, you know, obviously on Sundays, getting into the passenger of the car and you know, victory lane. So I remember growing up watching that. And then it's finally really cool to obviously meet him, but get to work with him and help him and driver coach him. So it's coming all full circle for me. And I just, it's a dream come true. And I don't think it's really set in yet. Obviously I've been doing this for a while now, but it still doesn't set in how much I'm privileged to be where I'm at now.
It's just so awesome. And I was just thinking when you're talking about this, it's great that you're helping these drivers out, because in a way you're kind of making sure the live stream of NASCAR is healthy and strong. And who knows, these might be your future teammates. These could definitely be your future competitors. But in a way, when you guys are racing out there, you might be going door to door with each other. But when it's the end of your careers, you're getting this, you know, sit back and remember all of this. You can say, hey, remember that time I was your coach, and you know, you were kind of in legends in Charlotte. So it's just so cool to hear these stories. And it makes me already hear those legends cars and bandoleros going around that circular track in the tri-oval. So it's just so cool. Oh man. Well, I got a couple more questions for you, because I know you've got a busy time, I'm sure, despite, you know, this being Father's Day weekend. You know, if you got to be a Sirius XM DJ for a day, right, what would be three songs that you would play that you feel best personifies who you are?
Oh, that's a hard question. I have never been asked that. that's a tough one. I like country music a lot. I don't really know, like, of a song, I guess, defines me. I mean, that's a tough one. I've never really got asked that question, but I feel like there's songs out there, obviously, that define me as a person and who I am. But I think one of them would be like Stroker Ace, like the Born to Race song. Like, that's a really cool, that's a tough one. I'm serious. I've never been asked that. I really don't really know the answer to that question, but I like the country music. I like listening to like a Morgan Wallen, or I like something that's like a little older, like the 80s country. So I'm kind of all over the map. I like hip hop music or anything like that. So I don't know the answer to that question, but I just know that I like music, and I like to sing every chance I can get.
Let me ask you this. Maybe you've never been asked this. Do you sing in the race car?
Never sung in the race. Maybe like under a red flag or something when I was really, really bored, like for like 20, 30 minutes, but I never like sing while I'm racing. But I think I've sung a couple of times, like under red flag, you know, cause things, you know, it gets warm in there. You got to take your mind off of it. So I think I've done it a couple of times.
Well, if you ever get to be on NASCAR radioactive, when you get to make it, let's hope that this holds true in about a few years, because I would love to hear whatever song you have. And I hope that question doesn't screw you up in your next race, because I jokingly have asked this question, and I feel like I have caused a few confusions.
No.
Okay, cool. I don't want to be that kind of person that does that. Now, my last question, we'll do this again, I'm sure, Landon, because I'm having a lot of fun with you here.
Yes, me too.
If Hollywood approached you, and they will probably one day, who knows? If they approached you and they said, hey, we want to do the Landon Lewis movie, which actor would you choose to play you on the big screen?
What actor? There's a couple of them good ones out there. I think a good actor would probably be, that's a really tough one, because they're like you mentioned, there's a lot of good actors out there. So probably Tom Hanks, maybe. I mean, he's pretty good. He's just really funny and very serious at times. So I probably Tom Hanks would be a good one.
I think that's a really good answer. I'm imagining, though, this is not the older Tom Hanks, but more of like, say, the big Tom Hanks or. Like the 90s version of him. Yes. So yeah, he's a good choice for sure. Well, listen, Landon, I know you've got to get going and get ready for the summer shootout stuff and whatever is going on. But did you have any message you wanted to say to the fans at home who are going to listen to this interview?
Yeah, I would just like to thank everyone for, obviously, whoever listens to this. Thank you for listening in. And it's been really cool meeting you and being able to do this. And then obviously, I'd like to thank all my fans and supporters for helping me out every weekend and being there and being supportive, even if we had bad weeks. So I'd like to thank all of them. I'd like to thank ARI, Scott and Mike at ARI. I'd like to thank Kevin with Rent Source, Team Chevy for everything they do, Ron and Candace and the whole Hornaday family for being supportive of me and just welcome me into their family and treat me like one of their own. Wiley X sunglasses for everything they do. Keep my eyes nice and cool on a sunny day. And then obviously Bruce Cook and everyone at Cook Racing Technologies and all the guys over there for putting the work in every weekend to give me fast race cars every time I unload and making my job a little bit easier. And then obviously the last one would be Roundy with MMI for the support when we go out west. So there's a lot of people that I like to thank. Obviously my mom and dad, I forgot, don't forget them because they're very supportive of my career. But a lot of people I like to thank. I'm probably forgetting a couple, but they know who they are and I can't thank everyone enough.
It's all good, my friend. And then that's, you got the two most important people out there, your parents. So that's all that matters. No, I'm kidding. Everyone else matters too. But I really enjoyed talking to you and we'll have you back on the hot seat very soon, I'm sure. And of course, on the YouTube edition of this, because I'm going to put it on YouTube over the weekend. Happy Father's Day to my dad, Virgil. And I'm sure you want to say happy Father's Day to your dad.
Yes. I'd like to sing happy Father's Day to my dad, Jonathan. He's just been really supportive of me through my whole career. And if it wasn't for him making that phone call, I probably wouldn't be where I'm at now. So big thanks to him. And we love all our fathers, because if it weren't for them, we wouldn't be where we are. So I'd like to say happy Father's Day to everyone.
For sure. Landon Lewis here in the hot seat. Thank you so much for joining us. And of course, my thanks to Taylor Kitchen. Of course, as you know, was a member of the TPF team, and now she's doing really well with the Team Hornaday Development Camp, and of course as well of Above the Yellow Line podcast on the Toby Christie Network. Now for our last interview to cap things off before we get ready to get to the ending part of our podcast, I had the pleasure and opportunity to talk to 2016 Indianapolis 500 winner and currently the driver of the number 7 Arrow Dallara McLaren Chevrolet entry in the NTT IndyCar Series, that of course being Alexander Rossi. This was a bit before the Road America race weekend, and currently Rossi is having a really respectable season, looking very strong and just overall doing what you expect from this talented competitive driver who has a pedigree in racing in F1. And now he's made his presence known as a IndyCar racer. After being in Formula One, he's currently ranked 7th in the point standings heading into this weekend's race at Mid-Ohio. So without further ado, for the final part of Hot Seat, here is Alexander Rossi. Welcome back to another edition of the Podium Finish Live here with your host, Rob Tiongson. And I'm joined alongside driver of the number 7 Arrow McLaren Dallara Chevrolet entry in the NTT IndyCar Series. That would be Alexander Rossi, winner of the 2016 Indianapolis 500. Alexander, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good, man. Thank you. Excited to get to Road America this weekend.
Certainly. And I know, as Pato mentioned to me recently, the track got repaved. So, I mean, before we get started, what do you anticipate with this ginormous road course now having a fresh blacktop?
Yeah, we were fortunate. We were able to actually test there last week. So to get a better understanding of what that's going to do to the car and, you know, the previous setup that the team had there. And, you know, every time that a course is repaved, like the grip level goes up pretty substantially. Road America was always, you know, fairly bumpy in places just because, you know, the tarmac was so old. So now it's incredibly smooth, very high grip. It's a lot of fun to drive, but it certainly makes your life easier, which means I think, you know, as always, it's going to be very close in IndyCar, but it'll be even closer now because, you know, I think a lot of guys are going to be able to get to the limit and put a big lap in.
Sounds like it's going to be a lot of brave times in qualifying, especially when you guys get to that sweeping right-hander into turn one. So I'm looking forward to that. And I'm sure the Arrow McLaren team's ready for any challenge ahead in these next 10 races. But let's talk about your season, because you're on a really good streak right now. You've got 4 straight finishes of 8th or better. You know, what are some of the things you're encouraged by with the number 17, you know, going into this race weekend? And what do you look to improve upon in these next 10 races?
Yeah, you know, I think it's been good. You know, obviously we don't do this to get top fives or top tens or whatever. You know, you want to win races. But I think coming in, you know, I think we were all very realistic about the fact that there was a lot of new people coming on board. There was a lot of new pieces. coming together within the organization. The team was growing pretty aggressively from 1 year to the next. So the first couple of races, everyone was just still trying to figure out, you know, the strengths and weaknesses that each individual, you know, kind of on the seven car had. And, you know, I think we were able to really make good progress early on. And now it really does feel like, you know, one whole team that's, you know, cohesively working with three cars. And, you know, I think that performance kind of speaks for itself. You know, there's been good results, you know, from all three of us so far this year. But we're all still chasing, you know, the first win for the team. So that's priority number one. You know, I think our performances on Sundays have been strong. I think qualifying has certainly been a little bit of a weakness. So yeah, that's what we, you know, we focused on at the Road America test. And you know, it's a tough championship. You know, it doesn't matter if you're good last week, you know, it all resets again this week. So you're only as good as your last race, and you got to continually go out there and prove yourself.
For sure. I mean, IndyCar racing is one of the most competitive forms of racing anywhere around the world. But I feel like with the closer competition and the great talent in the series, you know, it's probably one of the most exciting seasons to date in IndyCar, which is exciting to see, to say the least. And speaking of, it's your first year with the Arrow McLaren organization. You know, what has it been like for you to settle with this team and, you know, get to work with Pato and Felix and also TK earlier this year?
Yeah, you know, it was very cool for all of us to be able to share in Tony's last 500. You know, he's had such an amazing impact on the sport. You know, him and Elio are kind of the two faces of the Indianapolis 500. So to be able to spend a month with him on track was awesome. And also he's been a part of the team kind of from an advisory role from the start of this year, just, you know, kind of continuing on through the 500. So he's been a great addition to the organization. And then, you know, Felix and Pato are really fun to be around. They're obviously incredibly talented racing drivers, but they're also just good dudes, you know, away from the racetrack. So it's been a fun year for all of us. You know, we're only, you know, what is it, four months in, but it feels like we've all been working together for quite some time. And I'm excited to see what the future holds for all three of us.
Yeah, it feels like you guys have been together for a long time because of how well you guys are clicking together. So it's just weird, like you've mentioned, and it kind of hit me. It's only been 4 or 5 months really that you've been with the team, but I wouldn't have known that. It just seems like you guys are genuinely getting along, which is it's always good to have happen in any kind of dynamic for sure. Yeah. Now, IndyCar, like I mentioned, it's been growing by leaps and bounds. You know, I haven't seen it been this intriguing really probably since before the split happened. You know, how important is it for IndyCar to keep connecting with newer audiences and winning back some of those older fans who are now realizing, wait a second, I should have tuned in like a long time ago?
Yeah, you know, it's hard. You know, the motorsports as an entertainment property, whether it's IndyCar or Cup or F1 or whatever, it's evolving, right? The fan base is changing. Manufacturers and series partners have different priorities. And that's just a part of life, right? So it's up to us as the series and teams and drivers to really, you know, try and be on the forefront of that evolution. And I think IndyCar, you know, had a big hole to dig themselves out of. You know, you mentioned the split, obviously that changed the face of open wheel motorsports for the negative. And it's taken all this time to kind of get back to a level that, you know, we feel like we once had, and now it's about continuing to grow it in what is, you know, an ever competitive market for people's attention. You know, it's not just sports anymore. You know, it used to always be, okay, well, there's so many sports in America that people can watch. Now that everyone has access to so much entertainment, you know, in their pocket, you got to find a way to engage with new fans. So obviously IndyCar, you know, we got on board with a docu-series, right, 100 Days to Indy, which I think did a good job of at least introducing the sport and the human personalities behind the racing drivers. So I think that was very good. I think IndyCar is doing a lot of things from a sustainability standpoint, which is very important to a younger audience, a new fan base and also to our current partners and manufacturers that we have. So going hybrid next year, we're already on a 100% renewable fuel. Firestone already has a renewable tire. So we're really doing things that no other motorsport championship has done from that standpoint. So that's exciting. And then obviously, you know, the competition and the on-track product is our number one selling point. And it gets better and better every year. You know, it seems that every race is a mystery as to who's going to win. There's always some sort of drama that unfolds at some point in the race that captures people's attention. And that's what you need. So I think that everyone's doing a good job. It's still a long road ahead. But certainly since I came into the sport in 2016, I've seen it not do nothing but grow and go from strength to strength in the past, you know, 7.5 years.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you mentioned about that docuseries, which I think was so huge because, of course, it was on the CW network, which, you know, appeals to a lot of younger audiences who may have not been aware about you or Pato or all of these talented drivers. You know, Pato mentioned it was kind of an authentic look to seeing how teams were intensely getting ready for the greatest spectacle in racing. Would you agree with that assessment? And did you feel like it accurately portrayed, you know, what it's like to get ready for the Indy 500?
Yeah, no, I think they did a very good job. What's hard about doing, especially a limited series, what's hard about doing a series around IndyCar is you're never going to be able to introduce all of the storylines, you know, and it's a live sport. So you never know who's going to win, right? So it's a very challenging job for the producers to be able to kind of, you know, pick out these key moments and follow those stories as they progress and hope that it kind of lines up with the on-track actual results. But what I will give them a huge amount of credit for is everything was completely authentic. You know, as Pato said, they never asked us to do something. They never asked us to kind of rephrase the way we said something or try and create a story that didn't exist. So I think they very much wanted it to be a behind the scenes look. I think that if there's the opportunity there to do a second season, what you'll see is actually a lot more of the team dynamic, right? We got an introduction to what IndyCar racing is. We got an introduction to the drivers themselves and in, you know, their close family or friends or whatever. But you didn't really see a whole lot of what goes on to, you know, what makes a race car go quick and what is all the effort that goes into what is, you know, one of the bigger team sports in the world. You know, most of the time people think about the racing driver and they think, oh, well, that's really it because they're the forward facing individual. But you can be the best race car driver in the world and not have a good team and you're not going to get a result. So it is a huge team aspect and team sport that people don't realize. So I think that, you know, certainly there's some more stories to be told there. But all in all, for our first season, I think it was amazing. I think obviously it was kind of a cool coincidence that they were able to have Joseph win the 500 after he was kind of one of the main characters. And I was actually talking to one of the producers after the season finale, and he was like, yeah, man, like people will think it's scripted because the American guy who had always wanted to win it and came up short, who's married to a Disney princess, ended up winning the Indy 500 in the season finale. So it was actually kind of a cool story how it all came together. But yeah, as I said, very happy with the show and hopefully we get another season.
I hope so too, just because it's so neat to see IndyCar getting all this exposure. And I know for a fact as a journalist, IndyCar can't be fixed. It's just so hard to even get you guys to be in positions to make, you couldn't script it better, honestly. So, I mean, and if you did, you would have wanted to win the race anyway. Which I know you try your best. But no, I think it's a bunch of hocus pocus if people think it's not, it was scripted. So we'll leave it at that for sure. But for somebody who's never driven any car, AKA me, I've always wondered, what is it like to drive your number 7 car at a place like Road America or a super speedway like Indy?
That's a big answer. I think what the easiest way to explain it is, you know, these cars, people think about, oh, you go 240 miles an hour to Indianapolis. And it's like, yeah, but the car is also designed to do that. You know, you're not going to go do 240 miles an hour in a Chevy Camaro, right? That's just not reality. So the car actually begins to get more stable, and it has more grip, and it has kind of more capabilities the quicker you go, because that's just how, you know, a car with downforce works. And so there's kind of a mental barrier that you have to break through, because your mind feels as though you're going really quick, but actually the car, the faster you go, especially through the corners, the better actually perform. So once you kind of get used to that, it's actually it does feel slow. And I only say that because the human body has an amazing ability to slow things down. And we actually notice it when we step away for the off season, right? And then you get back in the car 5-6 months later, and you go to the first preseason test, and it's like, oh my God, this is really fast all over again. And then a couple hours goes by, and your mind kind of reacclimates, and everything goes back to normal. So yes, when you're at the limit, it actually shouldn't feel fast. It should feel pretty normal. And then when you look at like a road course, like Road America, for example, the challenges with that is because it's a road course, right? You've got a lot of different things going on. It's not just about going fast in a straight line. You know, there's braking zones, there's different speed corners, there's obviously different radiuses of corners, there's different grip levels depending on where you are on the track. The car's a lot more sensitive to tire temperature and fuel load and that sort of thing. So you're kind of thinking more consciously when you're driving on a road course, whereas on an oval, it's more subconscious, if that makes sense. Because you're thinking about a lot of different variables on a road course that maybe don't exist on an oval. So it's what we've been doing our whole lives. You know, if I were to go, you know, get on a basketball court and try and play in the NBA finals, like, you'd have no chance, obviously. It's the same thing for someone that's never driven a race car. You're not going to get an IndyCar, Road America, and be competitive. But, you know, when you've been doing this since, you know, you're 10 years old, it pretty much becomes second nature.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. And I think that's one of the best answers I've ever had to the whole.
Well, that's good.
Help me understand racing from your perspective. So I love that. And man, I'm gonna have to sit and think about that after this interview, just to think that 240 just feels normal. Because for me, I have a hard time going 50. So I'm one of those people you don't want to be behind in the car, in the highway.
The other comparison I'll give you is, like, if you're sitting passenger seat in a road car, right, and someone's going 80 miles an hour, and even if you're looking ahead, like, it feels fast. Like, it feels like you're moving quickly. As soon as you switch over to the driver's seat and you do the same thing, it doesn't, right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, even 50 miles an hour, there's a very big change that happens as soon as the mind-body connection of you being in control of the vehicle kind of begins, and then your mind just starts to slow everything down.
I'll have to remember that the next time I hit up a go-kart at COTA. So we'll see how that works out. Awesome. Now, for you, you mentioned you obviously embarked on your IndyCar journey back in 2016, which I know may have not been your original plan, but obviously you've made a career out of this in this division. You know, how do you perceive your journey going from where you were to this IndyCar sensation to one of the most respected drivers in the circuit in 2023?
Yeah, man. I mean, it's an ever-changing journey, right? You know, when I went to Europe in 2009, I had a certain goal, and I wanted to be an F1 driver, and that was really all that I cared about. And then, you know, we chased that dream and that passion for a while over there, and in some ways it achieved it in 2015. And then, you know, I my career and life looked to be going a certain way all the way through February of 2016. And then it all very abruptly changed. And I was very fortunate that, you know, there was an opportunity that arose in IndyCar with Andretti Autosport. And, you know, I came over kind of on a whim on a one-year deal and didn't really know much about the series, know much about what I was doing. I just, you know, needed to drive something in 2016. Surprised ourselves and everyone when we won the 500, and then that really set my career off in a direction to have a home back in the States. And what I realized was I love this sport more than anything that I'd ever done in Europe. Not because Formula One or European racing isn't amazing, but because as a kid, when you fall in love with this sport, it's because you love winning and you love competing and fighting for the chance to win. And quite frankly, in F1, that doesn't exist. You know, that's just the way the championship is set up as a manufacturer's championship. And so I think you talk to any of the guys that have come over from F1, whether that's myself or Romain or Marcus or whoever, right? They kind of get a new lease on life, and they fall back in love with racing because they know that every single weekend they've got as good of a shot as anyone else to go out there and win the race. So that was something I didn't really realize until I got involved in it. And yeah, so obviously had a great time span, a great amount of years with Andretti, and the opportunity came this year to make a switch to Arrow McLaren and to leave Honda and join Team Chevy and all of these things that, you know, for me, it was a very clear and easy decision. And, you know, I'm so grateful for the opportunity to kind of go to the next chapter of my career in IndyCar with this organization. And it's got off to about as good of a start as you could have hoped. So, you know, you just, like I said at the beginning of this, you know, you're only as good as your last race. You gotta continually go prove yourself regardless of what you've done in this sport. And that's all we're focused on right now.
No, for sure. We're glad to have you in IndyCar racing. So we're happy it worked out for you in this division, and glad to do the story with you. And I got one more question before I wrap this up, and just to kind of turn it around a little bit. What are a few songs that you would feel best describes who you are in terms of your personality and racing style?
Songs?
Yeah.
Oh, man. That's... man, you're asking the wrong guy. I don't know that I have ever had a song that I felt like defined me. Maybe I don't listen to enough music. I'm looking at my phone.
That's okay. To see what I listen to.
It's gonna be one song, bro. There's not a list here. Probably should have paid more attention to this. Let's go with, well, that's a pretty aggressive song. That's okay. Have you heard of Five Finger Death Punch?
I have not.
That's probably a good thing. They're pretty terrible. But there is a song called Jekyll and Hyde that I can sometimes relate to. So we'll go with that one.
I'll listen to it, and I probably will have a
you don't need to. But I mean, if you want, that's...
I'm adventurous, okay?
Okay,
that's what we'll do. But listen, I know you got to get going and get ready for Road America race weekend. So, Alexander, I really appreciate you joining me here on TPF Live. You want to say anything to the fans before we wrap it up?
Just thank you, everyone, for following along, whether you're a fan of me or not. Thank you for being a fan of IndyCar, and hopefully we can see you all at a race here very, very soon. So take care, everyone, and make sure to tune in to NBC this weekend for Road America.
You betcha. And that was Alexander Rossi here in the hot seat. My thanks, of course, to Alexander for making that possible. And I also want to thank the kind folks at Arrow McLaren Racing, specifically Alex Kraya and Lauren Guandion for making that happening for us. So thank you so much, guys. And thank you much, Lauren, for making that possible. That was a lot of hot seat interviews, but we hope you enjoyed that because we're, you know, of course, celebrating the 4th of July, you know, all about celebrating America, the independence from the motherland and the UK. But most of all, it's pretty much the unofficial halfway mark into the year 2023. So whether you're in Texas and it's screaming hot, or you're up in New York State where I don't think it's screaming hot, either way, it's going to be
a hell of a week. It's been wet.
It's been wet. Okay. Well, at least I got sunshine, folks. I guess that's where I'm doing well.
It's smoky. It's smoky again up here too.
Oh, you guys are getting the Canadian smoke wildfires again, aren't you?
Yeah, it's really bad in Chicago right now. So that's actually something to keep an eye on for this weekend, as well as the weather. I think there's like a 70% chance of rain on Sunday too.
Oh, goodness gracious.
So we have some Mother Nature factors involved.
I hope Mother Nature is not telling us not to race in downtown Chicago, but I'm not making that joke or anything. But oh boy, So as we get ready for Independence Day weekend, I'm going to quote what I said last year. Don't be Jason, Pierre, Paul. Be safe. Leave it to the professionals. And instead, enjoy some barbecue, make some good memories with family and friends, and watch a lot of racing. That's what we want you to do. And oh yeah, go shop at spoileddadcast.com. Promo code TPF. So with that, folks, I think it's time to go ahead and wrap up the show. So for Nathan Solomon, Mike Rockenfeller, Landon Lewis, and Alexander Rossi, I'm Rob Tiongson saying thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of TPF Live, the world's fastest hour of racing talk. For previous editions of our show, check us out on Spotify, Stitcher, and Apple Podcasts. And until next time, folks, let's go get that checkered flag, and we will see you out there. So long, everyone.